Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing political phenomenon that is dominating the headlines and causing the GOP establishment serious heartburn, and that is the continuing rise of Donald Trump in the Republican presidential primary race, where the latest PP poll in New Hampshire has Trump at 35%, with Bush trailing at 7%, Walker at 7%, and Rubio at 6%, meaning that all three of them combined are trailing Trump by 15%. Robert Creamer, a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Why Trump Could Win the GOP Nomination, and why the unbridled egotism of Trump and his right-wing populist demagoguery is striking a chord with Republican primary voters. Then we'll investigate the burgeoning rumors that Vice President Joe Biden is considering a run for the presidency in 2016, thus challenging Hillary Clinton, who already has a serious challenge on her left from Bernie Sanders. Ed Kilgore, the principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog and the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, joins us to discuss what substance there might be behind the buzz about Biden and what the consequence for the Democrats holding onto the White House might be for whichever candidate emerges from a bruising primary. Then finally, we will look into the riots in India and speak with Sumit Ganguly, the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. We will discuss the violence that has taken Prime Minister Modi's home state by storm, perpetrated by the affluent and powerful Patel clan, who curiously want to benefit from India's affirmative action program that gives government jobs and university placements to members of the OBC, other backward classes, in a quota system designed to help the country's historically lower castes. And joining us now is Robert Creamer, a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He is a partner in Democracy Partners, a senior strategist for Americans United for Change, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Why Trump Could Win the GOP Nomination. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Creamer.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And your piece at the Huffington Post, it really, I think, is onto it. I mean, I guess there's a lot of denial going on in the Republican Party, but Trump is not a joke. And Frank Luntz had a focus session on Monday, and he found out that he's not a joke. He's much stronger than Luntz thought. And he thought, when asked whether he'll be the nominee, Frank Luntz said it's now totally conceivable that he will be.
Well, on this, I'm afraid Frank and I agree. I think, for a long time, the punditry in particular and certainly the Republican insiders treated his candidacy as a joke or a humorous or a sideshow. And they just don't get out enough. I mean, I think the fact that he has tapped into an understanding that particularly, well, ordinary people in general are frustrated with their income situations. All the income for the last 30 years, all the growth has gone to the top 1%, guys like Trump, of course. But he's basically tapped into that frustration, and like any good right-wing demagogue, has pointed to the other as the cause, immigrants, foreigners, and people are not looking necessarily for great political experience. They're not looking for policy alternatives. That's what I think a lot of people in Washington particularly miss. They're looking for a strong man who can basically bring down the temple of the current establishment. And they think he qualifies because he's independent of them, doesn't have to take contributions. And that's, of course, the thing he plays to.
Well, I watched him yesterday. It was pretty extraordinary that MSNBC, Chris Matthews, who I think is their most popular show, they cut away from Chris Matthews to a Trump speech, as did CNN. And I watched it for quite some time. And he is unbelievably narcissistic. It's all about him. And he's telling all these inside stories about negotiating with the suits at NBC and all these friends on Wall Street, and this guy's a killer and we're going to get him in and he's going to negotiate better deals with the Chinese, believe you. We know that's all about him. And I was astounded that the only applause lines were when he talked about when he trashed Mexicans and foreigners. But it seems as though the audience there are forgiving this rampant egotism because he's striking a chord with them.
That's right. There is no doubt, I think, that this is a man whose drug of choice is attention. And that's been true throughout his career. But if anybody thinks he's going to give up on that, I mean, he's got a little dose of a stronger drug now. You know, the presidency is the absolutely most paid attention to person in the world. And he's seriously conceiving the possibility he could be that guy. So I don't think there's any question he's going to be in it to stay there. The fact is, I think people are looking at him, these kind, particularly, you know, frustrated white men are looking at him as a guy who's a strong guy who can, who's a son of a bitch. And of course, that's been his persona. He's developed it for years. The other thing about Trump that makes him so good, I mean, effective at what he's trying to do. A, he's been extraordinarily skilled as a guy who gets attention to himself. That's his whole career. This is not Bill Gates, who invented a whole new industry and got rich doing that, or Steve Jobs. This is a guy who's a latter-day P.T. Barnum. He's a promoter of himself. That's his whole trick. And he's gotten good at it for the last 25 years, so it's no surprise he's going to outstrip guys like Walker and Rubio. But beyond that, he also understands one key rule of politics: never be on the defense. He is the quintessential always be on the offense guy. And that really helps him, particularly weather these crazy things he says that would sink anybody else who started backpedaling.
Well, he's taken the Frank Sinatra idea of not apologizing to a higher level, wouldn't you say, Bob?
Oh, my God, yes. Has anybody seen him apologize for anything in the last 4 or 5 months since he's been in this race? Not a word. I don't want to underestimate, by the way, the extent to which Trump is demeaned the political dialogue in the United States with his attacks on immigrants in particular, and his outrageous comments about women, but that also translates into a consequence in the general election context. I mean, he's alienating 35% of the population right now is either African American, Hispanic, or Asian. He's pretty much done everything he can to alienate those people. A whole lot of women can't stand him. I think his ability to win a general election situation is extremely limited by what he's doing now. But his ability to win a primary is a different matter altogether. And by the way, the election math works for him in a lot of ways. If he can actually keep his 25-30%, you know, in the poll yesterday, PPP found him at 35 in New Hampshire. That was, by the way, 15 points more than Bush, Rubio, and Walker combined. 30 in South Carolina. If he can stay there, then he goes into these winner-take-all states, which will start after March 14th next year. Then he can rack up these huge delegate numbers. And I don't see anybody stopping him unless they're able to winnow the field and allow somebody to get traction who is the alternative. Well, we'll see how that happens.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Creamer, who's a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He is a partner in Democracy Partners, a senior strategist for Americans United for Change, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Why Trump Could Win the GOP Nomination. He certainly is not losing any friends amongst his constituency taking on the press. He kicked out Jorge Ramos of Univision out of a press conference. He derides the press. He's now going after the Megyn Kelly at Fox. I was amused by the fact that in the first go-around, in the first debate, which was clearly Fox, Murdoch, and Ailes rigged it to try and trash Trump, and he trashed Megyn Kelly and lo and behold, he just boycotted Fox until Roger Ailes came begging to him to put him back on the air, because Ailes doesn't want, he knows that Trump's followers are a big chunk of Fox News's demographics. So he really skillfully plays the media and plays his constituents off against the media.
Well, and as he points out, he's good at leverage. His money and his ability to attract attention gives him enormous leverage with respect to the other Republican, the Republican establishment, because he is one guy who could credibly threaten an independent run, and an independent run by Donald Trump would sink the Republican candidate for president, right? I mean, I can't imagine that it would give the Republican candidate for president any space to win. Ross Perot helped get Bill Clinton elected the first time, but this guy, I mean, he would take a big chunk of Republican voters, and maybe some Democrats too, and independents. But by and large, obviously, Republicans.
Well, but this is a nightmare scenario for the Republican establishment either way, isn't it? If he becomes a nominee, or if he runs as a third party candidate,
it's a serious problem for them. I mean, I said at the end of that article, you know, if he continues to do what he's doing now, he is not just giving the Republican Party heartburn. He's the establishment. He's going to give them a coronary. I mean, this is a nightmare scenario for them in many ways. You know, the one thing I would say, of course, is that, you know, giving Donald Trump, if Donald Trump had any chance of becoming president of the United States, that would be a terrifying prospect, I think, for many Americans. And for somebody said yesterday, I think that it would be like giving a machine gun to a monkey. Well, that's true. I mean, in terms of the danger that would pose, I mean, Trump is an unpredictable guy who takes himself as seriously as he projects. Now, I don't want to underestimate the fact that he's also a very skilled, demagogic player. I mean, a lot of what he's doing is very calculated. I mean, it's not like he's just, you know, all these comments he makes are intended to get attention. And that's what they do. And he's been very successful so far at doing that. We'll see where he moves going forward.
Well, he started out when he announced. He threw the biggest bombshell of all, right?
Yep.
I mean, there's something going on. There's a real strategy there. There's almost an element of mischief. I know some of the liberal commentators, like Rachel Maddow, even suggested that maybe he was some kind of sophisticated Democratic Party plant.
Well, talk about something that estimates the brilliance of the Democratic Party way out there. That would be quite a sophisticated plan if that were the case.
Right, right. Well, you know the Democratic Party well, and it sort of goes back to what Will Rogers said, right? That I don't belong to any organized political party.
I'm a Democrat.
I'm a Democrat, yeah. So, Robert Creamer, then, at this point, let's look at the other side. It's not as if the Democrats don't have a potential train wreck with the possible entry of Vice President Biden.
Well, I wouldn't call it a train wreck. I mean, it would certainly complicate life for a lot of people. There are a lot of people who are Democrats who love Joe Biden and probably would prefer to see Hillary Clinton as the nominee or Bernie Sanders. And it's yet unclear to me exactly, if he were to enter the race, who he would take most of the votes from, to be honest with you. But it would certainly throw everybody's calculus up for grabs. And I don't want to venture a guess as to whether the vice president will decide he wants to enter. I think he's always wanted to be president, that's for sure. Question is, does he see a viable pathway? And I don't know what the answer will be. I will say this, by the way. I think Hillary Clinton's the rap among the same gang that always said that Trump can't win on Hillary lately has been, oh, why can't she put this email thing behind her and so on. You know, my personal judgment is the email thing is a completely non-issue in general with normal voters, as is Benghazi. A lot of people think, you ask normal people what do they think of Benghazi, they think you're talking about something you rub on your arm to prevent it from hurting. You know, I mean, this kind of inside chatter that defines what is up and down in politics, I think very often it really misses what normal people are thinking about. I think Hillary has a very well-organized campaign, and she will, like a laser, focus on the things that really need to be focused on in order for her to win the nomination, for her to win. Joe Biden's entry, if it were to happen, certainly would throw things up for grabs on that front. The other thing is Bernie's ascendance has certainly had a big impact in the party, and he was really smart, in my judgment, to have to set up as his metric not fundraising and not poll numbers, which, you know, you've got to demonstrate you can have some traction, and he chose turnout at these events, and he's been quite successful at doing that, and that's, of course, allowed the bandwagon to build for him.
Yeah, but the two questions you would ask following that, Robert Creamer, is one, why didn't Hillary do what Bernie's doing? And two, does the entrance, or the possible entrance of Vice President Biden into the race, is that in a sense a signal to the Democratic Party and the base that there's something wrong with Hillary?
Well, it would certainly, if Biden entered, he would think he had a vulnerability for Hillary. In a primary like this, though, a lot of it, you know, I can't tell you, Ian, I think in general, certainly on policy, the Democratic Party is more united today than it has been in 30 years. The economic narrative that everybody will adopt is a populist economic narrative that requires, I mean, that says basically we need growth that benefits everyone, not just CEOs and big corporations. And part of the decision will be who's most credible at projecting that, but the broader questions of the people involved will be, you know, and your general likability and trust and so on of those people will be very important. The chattering class thinks that Hillary is more vulnerable, I think, than I think normal voters do. A lot of people have been energized by Bernie's telling it like it is about the thing that they care about most, which is the fact that for them the economy has not been producing gains. It's only been producing gains for the guys like Trump. And he's got a lot of traction by saying it like that. Hillary does have to has to go out there and excite people if she's going to win the election. And I'm betting that we're going to see a lot more of her beginning to do that as the fall begins here.
Well, just in closing, back to Donald Trump, and it does tie into this populism you're talking about that Bernie Sanders is being rewarded with on the stump and with these huge crowds. It obviously resonates, but it sort of gets to my mind to the very bifurcation amongst the American working class and middle class, in the sense that traditional left-wing politics in Europe and other countries, unions, etc., like that, have been steadily weakened because the narrative of left-wing, you know, values and social democracy has been attacked so relentlessly. And the right wing has come up with, and the Christian right has come up with an alternative, like the prosperity gospel and all of this other garbage that is basically, and you too can win the lottery and just have to work hard. And if you don't work hard, it's your fault if you're poor. Those are the narratives, and clearly the latter is the narrative that Donald Trump is attracting, the idea that I'm a billionaire and you too can be a billionaire and some of my fairy dust can rub off on you.
Right. I mean, and that's right. And Donald, of course, God knows, everybody thinks he's successful, at least financially, and people follow winners. But I wouldn't underestimate the extent to which, I mean, our message, a progressive economic message, we know from the polling, trumps, no pun intended, trumps the right-wing populist and the right-wing establishment alternatives. It's much more compelling. Of course, it has the additional benefit of being true, right? It's not immigrants that have caused the country problems. It's that all the money has gone to CEOs and corporations and big banks. See, most of the positions that Democrats take today that excite our base also appeal to swing voters. That wasn't always true in America. It is also true that many of the positions that Republicans take that excite their base are complete turnoffs to swing voters. They have a much bigger problem on that front than we do today. You're right that there's been a relentless attack on the institutions that underlay American progressive, the progressive movement in the United States, chief among them attacks on the labor movement. And we may see more of that in the next year. One of our most important priorities, clearly, is going to be the revitalization of labor in the United States. It's the foundation of all progressive activity, in my judgment. But that does not mean that our values and our narrative and our principles are not extremely popular. I think they are. And that's why I think, as you pointed out at the beginning, that's why I wrote a book called Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. We advocate for those things. People will follow us.
Well, Robert Creamer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good to be with you, man.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Creamer, who's a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He is a partner in Democracy Partners, a senior strategist for Americans United for Change, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Why Trump Could Win the GOP Nomination. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back investigating the burgeoning rumors that Vice President Joe Biden is considering a run for the presidency in 2016. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ed Kilgore, the principal writer for The Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He is also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and he is the author of Elections 2015, Why Republicans Swept the Midterms. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Thanks a lot.
And do you think the rumored and possible entry of Vice President Joe Biden into the Democratic presidential primary is going to be bad for the Democrats, if not a disaster? Could he be the Democrats' Donald Trump? Not that there's any comparison, but the extent to which Donald Trump appears to be absolutely giving heartburn to the GOP establishment. What is the response with the Democratic Party establishment in terms of the vice president entering the presidential primaries?
Well, I have to challenge the premise here. I don't really believe a lot of the reports that he's right on the brink of running. You'll notice they're almost invariably unsourced. And, you know, some or a handful of people scattered around the country that really want him to run. So I've seen no credible evidence that he is planning to run. And just because he doesn't make a Sherman statement, you know, just swearing he won't under any circumstances run, is not, you know, to me, proof that he's going to. It's rare for people to rule it out. The second thing is that, you know, there is a contingency, a very remote one, on which the Democratic Party may be shopping for another candidate if something really terrible happens to Hillary Clinton. I don't think it's going to, but again, it could look different 2 or 3, 4 months down the road. If, on the other hand, I'm wrong, Joe Biden jumps in right away, I think it would be very destructive for the Democratic Party, not so much as a thing in itself, but because the only real way Joe Biden could run a credible campaign against Hillary Clinton is by basically echoing the very inflated claims of, you know, Clinton scandals that conservative media are constantly cooking up. And that would be very, very destructive, particularly since I don't think Joe Biden could beat Hillary Clinton in any kind of straight-on or even three-way contest.
So in terms of what you just said about the conservative drumbeat of scandal that is largely manufactured, you know, if you go back to Whitewater, when Bill Clinton first emerged, that was a completely manufactured scandal. But
yeah,
it sure as hell got a lot of headlines, as did all of the subsequent ones, some of them deserved. And now, you know, the opinion that you hear amongst nervous Democrats is that Hillary just can't get out from under this email scandal or even Benghazi. So do you think that people get it, that this is a machine, that it's the woman against the machine?
Well, again, I have to challenge the premise. There have been a handful of mostly state polls, mostly from one pollster, Quinnipiac, suggesting some sort of plunge in Hillary Clinton's favorability ratings and her standing against other candidates, particularly Republicans. You know, the last national poll that came out from CNN showed her beating every single named Republican in a general election trial heat. So, you know, this idea that she's in some sort of death spiral is a planted axiom by conservatives who, frankly, don't want to face her and would just as soon see somebody else, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, whoever, become the Democratic nominee. In 2008, people said, you know, sort of the cumulative effect of Clinton scandals, hers or husband's, real, imagined, would take her down. Actually, the only thing that took her down, and it was a near thing, was an extraordinary candidate named Barack Obama. So, I mean, the truth is Hillary Clinton is the most thoroughly vetted politician in the country. You know, of course, it's always possible something will come up about any candidate that could be sort of a silver bullet, but I think she's probably among the least likely for that to happen to. So unless there's some real evidence that the public, not just Republicans and not just Republican-leaning independents, you know, is buying that she's fundamentally dishonest, then I don't think there's any reason for any kind of Democratic panic.
And again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's the principal writer of the Washington Post Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and he's the author of Elections 2015, Why Republicans Swept the Midterms. But clearly, though, the polls, certainly in New Hampshire, the first primary, indicate that you basically got Bernie Sanders. He was tied, and some of the more recent polls just out give him a lead over Hillary Clinton. That's nothing to do with the Republicans. That's right.
That's true. Bernie Sanders will very likely win New Hampshire. And if he can't win New Hampshire, he shouldn't be running. It's next door to his own state. He's extraordinarily well-known there. And, you know, there's really almost no reason he shouldn't win there. Do the Clinton people wish that were not the case? I'm sure they do. But you know, as you know, at the moment, right now, Hillary's lead over Bernie Sanders in national polls is about 2-1. She's well ahead in Iowa. And there's yet to be any kind of survey outside the early states showing Bernie Sanders doing anything at all. So, no, he's turned out to be a very lively, very effective candidate. An awful lot of Clinton supporters actually are sort of quietly cheering this because they want to keep her honest, keep her tested, keep her ready for a tough general election. But, you know, I don't think... The funny thing about the Biden talk is that if Biden entered the race, it's not 100% clear to me how that's going to affect things. Right now, for some reason, pollsters have started including Biden in the Democratic primary polls. He's running at about 10, 11, 12% in most of them. I doubt he's going to take too many votes away for Bernie Sanders because they're not very similar. And again, that leads to my major worry about it. He's close enough ideologically to Hillary Clinton that the only way he could really differentiate himself is by piling on to conservative attacks on her for various, you know, scandals, mostly imaginary. So, but I have no idea what would happen if he did get into the race. But right now, Hillary Clinton's standing to win the nomination is not in serious doubt, though, you know, obviously she has to take Bernie Sanders seriously.
So then, Ed Kilgore, what then do you make of the Washington Post story that Biden, a possible Biden run, puts Obama's fundraising network on high alert, and that the argument is here is that a lot of the party, big money people in the party, are already convinced that Biden's going to make a late entry, and they're holding back their money that would otherwise go to Hillary, and that this is creating a real angst in terms of Hillary's donor base.
Well, who knows who to believe? There was a Glenn Thrush piece in Politico today that seemed to be based on more immediate sources in the Biden circle than some of the other stuff we've been hearing. And according to Glenn Thrush, Biden's soundings of major donors indicate that nobody's willing to back him. So who knows? You know, right now, the one thing we do know is that a lot of the political talent in the Obama 2008-2012 campaigns is already on board for Hillary Clinton. You know, she's doing okay, certainly doing okay with fundraising. Everything else is just completely pure speculation, and there's certainly no evidence that the administration is en masse getting behind some sort of Biden campaign that I've seen. I mean, it's interesting. Just yesterday, Governor Tom Vilsack of Iowa endorsed Clinton, and I mean, there were actually stories indicating that, wow, he's defying the Obama, you know, he's an Obama cabinet member endorsing Hillary against Biden. And even the people making that argument don't seem to be aware that Tom Vilsack was a 1988 Joe Biden supporter, very close to the vice president. The more I look at it, the more I think that, you know, whereas he hasn't ruled anything out and a late draft would be possible if something unimaginable happens, the guy's probably not running.
Well,
a lot of this is just kind of airy speculation.
Right, but the person who could put it to rest, surely, Ed Kilgore, is the vice president himself. Now, you suggested that, well, what do you suggest is going on? Is he enjoying the limelight? My understanding is the poor guy is mourning the loss of his son. There's nothing.
Yeah, he's probably not as focused on any of this as most of us seem to assume. That's number one. Number two, there are politicians, and I've known them, that would never, ever, ever in a billion years rule out a future presidential run. You know, they're not out there encouraging it, but they're not going to rule it out either. From everything I've heard about Joe Biden, he is one of those people. It just ain't going to happen. The day Hillary Clinton is nominated, he still will not have ruled it out. That doesn't necessarily mean anything. So maybe I'm wrong. I don't have any inside sources. I don't know the guy. But, you know, the logic of the situation is such that I can understand why he wouldn't want to rule it out in case something crazy happens. But that's not the same as, you know, plotting a campaign.
So when I mentioned earlier about Donald Trump, and we started out talking about him, and I feel in many ways, you know, when I look at the headlines and the websites in the morning to figure out what news to cover during the day, half of the stories are about Donald Trump. It's just nauseating. So, but nevertheless, I did cover it in the segment.
Well, I mean, I understand. I wouldn't compare the two.
No, I'm not comparing the two. I'm just saying that that was a preface to me asking you a question about Donald Trump.
Go ahead.
Okay. So Frank Lutz had this meeting the other day on Monday with a group of Trump supporters to drill down and figure out what makes them tick. And he ended up completely befuddled and said, I've just experienced an alternative universe. He says, you know, that this support for Trump is much, much stronger and much more solid than I would ever expected. When asked, do you think that Trump could be the nominee? He said, it's totally conceivable that he will be. He went on to talk about Trump in terms of, well, he said 21 out of the 29 in the focus group said they'd vote for Trump as an independent candidate. And Luntz ended up by saying, this is stronger than Perot. This is more intense than Perot.
Yeah, well, I assume that's what Frank Luntz thinks. I don't know that you necessarily are going to understand what's happening politically through any kind of focus group. It's just one of many tools. That just happens to be the one that Frank Luntz uses. My own theory is that Trump is taking advantage of two interrelated phenomena that he's almost uniquely equipped to take advantage of. One is the non-college-educated white voters, so-called white working class, that have moved so heavily into the Republican column in recent decades and have never quite accepted the party elite view of economic issues. And by economic issues, I mean everything from how to deal with entitlements to immigration policy. He has hit on all of those weak points Republicans have with that particular constituency. He's opposed to Social Security and Medicare cuts. He's in favor of a very draconian immigration policy, unlike Republican business elites. And then the second phenomenon is the Republican conservative rank-and-file voters who do not understand how this 2014 landslide victory that I wrote about in my book, why it hasn't produced results. And they think they're being betrayed. So a candidate who's more aligned with them on certain key issues and who tells them they ought to be outraged at the Republican members of Congress and the party leadership for failing to deliver on their promises and put Trump's universal name recognition and money behind it, and you got a phenomenon.
Well,
so, aren't you I think it's very real. I do not think he's going to win the nomination, but, I wouldn't bet $1 million against it if I had it. To me, the most telling bit of evidence we have so far is that, a lot of the rationalization about not taking Trump seriously flowed from the perfectly plausible argument that, he's running so well because it's a field of 17 people, and once the winnowing of the field occurs and it's Trump versus one or two or three more credible candidates, you'll see him fade. Public policy polling has started doing head-on-head matchups between Trump and other leading Republicans to kind of test that hypothesis. They did one the other day in New Hampshire, a very important state. Trump trounces each and every one of those leading candidates in one-to-one matchups. Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and Scott Walker in particular. So I guess people are going to have to take him a little more seriously than they have, or at least not assume that he's going to disappear by magic.
Well, Ed Kilgore, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate your time.
Not a problem.
And bye-bye. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council, communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, and he's the author of Elections 2015, Why Republicans Swept the Midterms. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the riots in India by a powerful affluent clan who curiously want to benefit from India's affirmative action program. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and India Since 1980. And his latest book is India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Thank you.
And what seems to be happening now in the state of Gujarat in India is not, even though riots are going on and about 70 buses have been burned and 40 police stations have been burned and a number of people have been killed, this apparently has nothing to do with the violence that took place in Gujarat in 2002 when religious riots led to at least 1,000 people dead, most of whom were Muslims, and this led to ostracizing Modi, who now happens to be the Prime Minister of India. So what's going on here?
What's going on over here is a very curious phenomenon. A community that is relatively well off and historically was composed of landowners for the most part, the Patels, are literally on the march, and they are demanding that they be included as a reserved category, which essentially means they would be eligible for various forms of affirmative action referred to as positive discrimination in India. And the Gujarat government has said that there is a 1992 Supreme Court ruling that says we cannot have reservations of more than 50% of the population in any given state because it violates the Equal Treatment Clause of the Constitution. If more than 50% of the population is composed of people who are in protected categories, then essentially the majority becomes a minority. So it would be a very curious inversion of what was really intended in India's affirmative action programs. And what is bizarre is that this is not a community that historically has faced much discrimination. So one wonders why they are literally up in arms.
Well, there's a firebrand, Hardik Patel, who's leading this community, but the community, the Patels or the Patidars, as you mentioned, they're quite prosperous, but they're also a kind of multinational family, if you will, in the US, Europe, and Africa. They are key players in India's diamond trade, but ironically, they've been major supporters of the BJP party that India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi belongs to. So is there something going on here? Did they think that because they supported Modi, and after all, the governor of the very state of Gujarat is a Patel, so did they feel that he owes them something? I mean, it's a bit hard to believe. This would be like everybody in Beverly Hills claiming they needed affirmative action.
Just about. I mean, like in every community, there are a certain number of Patels who may not be especially well off, but that would be true of virtually any community in the world. Not everyone of a particular ethnic stock are necessarily all wealthy. But as for the most part, this is not a community that has been oppressed or marginalized or is in dire straits by any means. And as you correctly pointed out, there's a very substantial diaspora stretching all the way from East Africa to parts of London and elsewhere in the world. The Patels are really quite socially and physically mobile. One possible explanation is that this is a not so subtle attack on the privileges that affirmative action has conferred on other ethnic groups in India. And this is an attempt possibly to demolish the entire edifice of affirmative action in the state of Gujarat. That this is probably, it's a plausible argument that this is simply a backlash against affirmative action. And by making this somewhat ridiculous claim that they are deserving of affirmative action, they could essentially end up gutting the entire scaffolding that exists of affirmative action in the state of Gujarat.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. And his books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, India Since 1980, and his latest, India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. So just to get a handle about what's possibly going to be dismantled here, this national program of affirmative action that I take it has been in place for some time in India, and it's an attempt to ameliorate the effect of India's class system, and it's a quota system for India's historically low class, legally termed the scheduled castes or scheduled tribes and other backward classes, OBC. So that's sort of pretty blunt language. It's not exactly politically correct, is it?
No, it's quite politically incorrect, but oddly enough, in the Indian context, it is not seen as pejorative. It was an attempt at a kind of a sociological classification, if you will, of other backward castes. Somehow or other, this has not attracted the ire of people, and quite the contrary, people have sought to get themselves classified as OBCs because it could confer significant benefits that would accrue to them from the government, like reservations for seats in medical colleges, in institutes of technology and engineering, in terms of government positions, and particularly government positions which offer the prospect of lifetime employment. So it's almost, I won't use the pejorative term racket to describe this, but certainly an attempt to socially constructing an identity which would then place you in a particular category and thereby make you eligible for governmental benefits.
So Gujarat is the home state of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And we mentioned the 2002 riots, which left about 1,000 people dead, mostly of them Muslims. This was largely blamed on Modi. He became a kind of person non grata. He was on the State Department's list of banned individuals, but since he was elected Prime Minister, obviously that changed. He has been elected on the Nationalist Party, the BJP, and he's a pretty odd duck, isn't he, in terms of being an incredibly religious man who lives an extremely abstemious life. And I believe he also comes from a lower caste, doesn't he?
He is not a member of, you know, one of India's really marginalized castes, but he's not, again, a high caste. So the caste system is actually quite sprawling and complicated and has an extensive hierarchy, and that hierarchical structure even varies from state to state. But he's hardly someone who came from, very margins of Gujarati society, even though he does not come from wealth, he does not come from privilege.
I see. So he's somewhere in the middle.
Yes.
So, but what do you make of him in the sense that he rose as a nationalist and in many ways you can't blame what's happening in Gujarat now, you can't blame it on him necessarily. But on the other hand, he did seem to dodge that huge bullet of the 2002 riots. And now he's saying that violence gets you nowhere. Does that ring true to you?
Well, of course he's going to suggest that violence is going to get you nowhere because this is in his home state. He is now the prime minister and he cannot be seen as someone who will condone violence. Furthermore, it damages the prospects of his own party in the state. Some of these agitators, particularly the young man who's leading the agitation, is saying that, you know, unless you respond to our demands, then in the 2017 state-level elections, we will exact a price, we will not vote for you, and you will pay the consequences for ignoring us. So accordingly, he must try to pour oil on troubled waters.
But who would these people vote for? I mean, what is...
Oh, they could vote for Congress. They could vote easily vote for Congress. And Congress has had a standing in Gujarat in the past.
I see. So it's not a question of right-wing or left-wing politics here. This is just power politics.
No, no.
Yeah. Just power politics, right?
It is. Very much so.
And patronage politics.
That's patronage politics. No question about it, because there's resentment against the benefits that have been doled out to various low castes in India. And this is another manifestation thereof.
Well, of course, we've seen that here in the United States, a backlash here in the state of California. A proposition was passed to undo affirmative action on the basis that white students were being denied education.
That's correct. And we've witnessed it in other states, in the United States also.
Right. So just to pull back and get an analysis from you, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, about where India stands now under this new leadership. What's your sense now that we're all, of course, looking at China and the extent to which China is a growing power and has had a bit of an economic hiccup of late that's wiped about $3 trillion of wealth off the global stock markets. And, of course, this is to do with perceptions that their economy is slowing, and that's why apparently why the price of oil has dropped substantially. So in that context, how is India doing?
India is not doing badly. But there is a sense of palpable disappointment in the business community in India, who had thought that Modi would significantly reduce the heavy hand of government, who would pass a land bill, because it's the previous land bill was tilted disproportionately in favor of farmers and existing landowners, making it extremely difficult to acquire land for industrial and commercial purposes. And Modi has been unable to demonstrate the necessary mettle, despite having a majority in parliament, at least in the lower house, to pass this land bill. He has also failed to pass nationwide goods and services tax, which would have brought in substantial revenue. And so his apparent timidity when faced with vociferous opposition has taken many people aback. Nevertheless, because of lower oil prices, because of some efforts that he has undertaken, including the cleanup of a very overexposed banking sector, the Indian economy has actually picked up some steam. But a great deal more could have been accomplished if he had succeeded in passing these two bills and also tackling India's behemoth public sector, much of it which is quite unproductive.
But the fact of the matter still remains that you still have enormous amount of poverty amongst the lower castes, a tremendous amount of, you know, incredibly poor agricultural practices, people living on the margins in a very feudal way. Basic things like clean water are hard to come by, and sewerage, etc. So the idea that the government for the longest time has instituted a program to try and raise up the lower castes and lower classes to raise their standard of living, if that's being rolled back in the macro sense, I don't see that as being a step forward. Even if the government patronage for the poor has ended up with a vast kind of sclerotic bureaucracy.
Yes, I think that's entirely true. But I am not in favor of trimming back government programs because of the widespread poverty that does exist in India. But I think there are better ways of alleviating poverty, for example, through direct cash transfers rather than programs which are set up by a vast bureaucratic apparatus where a great deal of leakage takes place and the intended targets do not benefit. I would much rather see direct cash transfers to the poor and enabling them to make certain life choices. And this actually might be possible if the government succeeds in an endeavor that was started under the previous government, and civil libertarians have expressed some anxieties about this because there is a possibility of misuse, and that is to create what is called a unique identity card for every Indian. And they have done this for several hundred million people already. And this card with biometric data would enable the government to transfer money in a targeted fashion. But this has not completely gotten off the ground. The card, the unique identity card, is off the ground, but not the next component of direct cash transfers.
So I guess the analogy from what you've told us, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, would be something like the Bureau of Indian Affairs that was supposed to take care of poverty on Indian reservations in the United States. And so much of that money gets wasted in that bureaucracy, and it doesn't reach the targets. And if you had a system that paid directly to the poor people or the poorest people, it would be much more efficient and much more effective. So
that's exactly right.
Well, is anybody talking about this?
I mean, there are increasing discussions amongst Indian economists about this. There is, in fact, an emerging body of literature which talks about how best to provide welfare provisions. And there is a debate that's underway. And if I can be so self-referential, I have an entire book coming out with a colleague here through Yale University Press next year, called Ascending India and Its State Capacity. And there is a detailed discussion of the efforts of the Indian state in this book to address questions of poverty and why they haven't worked and what strategies have actually led to an amelioration of poverty and what has been an abject failure.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, India Since 1980, and his latest is India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. And his forthcoming book is Ascending India and Its State Capacity.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time will pass.